Susan M. Sapper against Dennis Lee Ferguson Jr. Mark F. Lindenschmidt, Gregory S. Hummel, Eric D. Dills, Roger D. Greer for the accountant, Jason A. Hopkins, Jay Litton for the utility.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Mark Lindenschmidt for Susan Sauter, the plaintiff and appellant in this case. And if I may, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal in my argument. The court today has three questions before it, essentially three questions. I see them as this. One, did the trial court have discretion in this case to refuse to set aside what was obviously a void judgment? There was no question about the status of the judgment. Once the fact-finding was made at the trial court level, it was clearly void. Second, did Rockingham Mutual, the parent company, the homeowner's insurance carrier for the plaintiff in this case, not the UM carrier, have standing to intervene in this case to essentially argue to the court that the void judgment should not be set aside as void but should be left in place? And third, if this court agrees with us that indeed the void judgment should have been set aside in this case and there was no discretion on the part of the trial court to do that, to leave it in place, then is remand appropriate in this instance to return the matter to the rest of the trial court and for further proceedings in this matter? And we say, as to the first question, was there discretion on the part of the trial court? No. As to the second question, should the homeowner's insurer been allowed to intervene in this case? We say no. And as to the third question, should this case be remanded to the trial court for further proceedings? We say yes. This has, as you can see from the pleadings and the record in this case, sort of a long and I find unique procedural history, but let me see if I can bring us to the nub of it. It's an auto accident case.
Can I ask you this, counsel? Isn't the statutory provision 428 a codification of pre-existing equitable principles which chancellors have used since the time of Lord Coke?
Are you talking about the concept of judgment which is void? Is void?
No, specifically the motion practice under subsection A of 8.01.428.
Correct.
Isn't that a codification of pre-existing chancellery principles which have been around for a century or two, more than a century or two, many centuries?
I did not read it as that.
So it didn't exist before the statute? There was no authority to set aside a void judgment before the statute?
There absolutely is, under the common law.
No, under equitable law. Under equity,
well,
not common law.
I don't know if it's an equitable concept or not. I hadn't given that thought, but certainly it's a procedural concept that's longstanding. I mean, if there's no jurisdiction on the part of the parties, the court has no jurisdiction to enter an order in the case. As to whether or not that's an equitable principle or a due process principle,
Are you familiar with a bill of review in equity?
Pardon?
Are you familiar with a bill of review in equity?
I am not very familiar with equity practice at all. I'm sorry, Your Honor. In any event, we believe that the case should have been set aside as void, and because here's what happened. It was an automobile accident case. Susan Sauter obtained a default judgment against the defendant, Denny Ferguson. And under those circumstances, the homeowner's insurance, after the judgment was entered and after 21 days had run in this case, the homeowner's insurer stepped into the case and said, no, this was the UM carrier stepped in to the case for the first time in a separate declaratory judgment action and said, well, wait a minute, you didn't get proper notice on us, and also, by the way, you didn't get proper service of process on Denny Ferguson, and therefore you have no jurisdiction over this judgment. And the court had no jurisdiction, and therefore it can't be validly enforced. Well, upon investigation into the file and doing some further digging, Plaintiff's counsel determined that indeed it looked like it was problematic, that we had some service process issues concerning Denny Ferguson, as well as some issues concerning the notice to the homeowner, rather to the UM carrier. So when we discovered that, we, as soon as we could respond to their deck action and then sort of do some further investigation, responded to their claim by filing a motion to have the judgment set aside as void. The plaintiff is clearly entitled to under the statute, 428A. What the judge did in this case, as you can see from the record, is he entertained evidence in the case. He heard Denny Ferguson, who said, "I didn't know anything about any lawsuit until they brought these papers to me saying something about a default judgment." And so the evidence was clear that, in fact, he did not have service of process in this case. Under those circumstances, I don't see how the judge could have ruled not to set the judgment aside as void, because clearly it's void. It has no existence from the time it was entered into the...
How do you interpret the word may in subsection A?
Well, it clearly, may is usually considered to be permissive in rules of construction, but when the manifest purpose of the statute would be violated by construing it as merely permissive and not mandatory, that rule of construction needs to be modified, I believe, under the cases that we cited in our brief. For example, if it's clear that the judge has the power and authority under the statute to set it aside, and certainly may gives him that, if in fact the facts prove that the judgment was void, then the judge has no discretion to decide under whatever rules of discretion he decides to impose that in this instance I'm not going to set it aside, but perhaps in the next instance if the plaintiff did something else I will set it aside. There's really no standards for that under a discretion.
Counsel, let me ask you a question if I could. What you're saying is correct, and may mean shall. It means shall in all situations. Is that correct? Even if the plaintiff committed fraud, or even, let me give you a different hypothetical. Let's say in this case that you got a judgment not for the $300,000 you intended to get, but a judgment for $3,000. And you came back a little bit later and found out, well, maybe this judgment's void. We want to set this aside. But the defendant doesn't want it set aside. They're perfectly happy with the $3,000 judgment. Should it still be set aside?
It should be set aside if it was entered without jurisdiction, absolutely. As to the fraud question, obviously that was not an issue in our case, but I mean, in thinking it through, if somebody commits fraud or intentionally misrepresents something to the court in order to get a default judgment, then I think there are some instances where the court could refuse to set it aside.
But under Justice Millett's hypothetical, the extrinsic fraud would render the judgment void ab initio, no differently than the lack of personal jurisdiction. And if the statute is interpreted the way you interpret it, a plaintiff could use extrinsic fraud, get a judgment, later decide that strategically it's not the best thing for him, and then the plaintiff, the fraud feasor, could come back in and ask the chancellor to wipe out the void judgment. Why shouldn't that election be in the hands, or at least why shouldn't a chancellor have the discretion to want to hear from the victim of the alleged error, as opposed to the perpetrator?
Well, the judge should have heard from the alleged victim, although the victim did not show up except as a witness in the case. But I think I think principles of judicial estoppel, or even actually going back to the common law, the ex turpe causa concept. I mean, if you wrongfully, illegally represent something to the trial court in order to accomplish something, I think that would obviate your remedy that you might have under 428A as a plaintiff to then come back in and say, "Oh, well, I didn't mean it."
Discretion under your interpretation is just not applicable to your case.
As to fraud, I think there would be, but that's not what we have in this instance.
If your reasoning is correct, it's not possible for us to say that under the statute discretion is wiped out per se.
Well, I'm not exactly sure. Pardon me. I'm not exactly sure that the judge would even have any discretion under the situation where the plaintiff had committed fraud in order to accomplish the the default judgment. Yet under both instances, they would be void, but I think judicial integrity at some point would have to step in and not allow a plaintiff to do that.
Well, to push this hypothetical a little further, let's say the plaintiff waited 20 years and then asked that the judgment be set aside.
That's a good question, and it's quite possible that that would happen, I suppose. I'm not exactly sure why a plaintiff would wait 20 years to try to enforce a judgment that he thought he had 20 years ago, but in case he did, the statutes don't really speak to any time limit at all in terms of having a void judgment set aside.
But what does that do to the finality of judgments, if you're correct? If may means shall.
There is never going to be a finality to a judgment that's void at the time it was entered. It's non-existent. It's a nullity. It stops existing at that point and all points forward, if that answers your question.
Okay. Well, counsel, if we reverse the trial court, why wouldn't we dismiss this case with prejudice for failure to obtain service within a year under 3:5?
Well,
I mean, and the that's what happened in the Dennis versus Jones case.
Right. As I read the Dennis case, the only options that the court was left with at the end of the Dennis case was to dismiss with prejudice, because that's what the defendant asked for in that case, and the plaintiff never opposed that that resolution of the case, didn't argue otherwise that it should be remanded to the trial court for further proceedings, and just accepted the concept that it should be dismissed with prejudice, and instead argued that in fact he had used the plaintiff had used due diligence in that case, and therefore the judgment should stay in place.
Well, and that's a good segue to the declaratory judgment action that you mentioned. Is there anything about that action that if the trial court takes a position, and I mean obviously the trial court's going to rule in that case, would a judgment in that case move this appeal?
Would what to appeal in time?
This appeal. Would a judgment in the declaratory judgment action move this appeal?
I don't think there can be a judgment in the declaratory judgment action because it's based on a void judgment. If the judgment's void, it's void for all purposes, as for res judicata effect, or, you know, off into the future in terms of how it's...
But the UM carrier could win the DEC action without going to the voidness point. The UM carrier could just point out that the statutory notice provisions were not applied correctly, and whoever the underlying defendant was in the case, the tortfeasor in the case, Ferguson, the UM carrier is not liable. I mean, they can win the DEC action, can't they, without going to your point?
I don't believe so. I think the underlying claim that the DEC action is based on has to be taken into account. I mean, that's my opinion. I perhaps that's not right, but I think that's the way it would work, because the void judgment is void for all purposes. And so there's nothing really to base the DEC action on. There's no judgment to talk about.
But if the UM carrier doesn't get the statutory notice in a perfectly ordinary and non-void car wreck case, the UM carrier is not liable, right?
Correct.
All right, so one of their arguments in the DEC action is that the UM-UIM carrier notice statute was not complied with, so we're not liable. We can walk. Why can't the DEC action come to that conclusion and not address your point?
I think it's because it's based on void action. I mean, that's the way I analyzed it. Perhaps that's not correct, but I just don't see how void judgment can be used as a springboard for any other action. In this case.
All right, you have a minute and 40 seconds left.
We would also rely on our briefs and our the arguments that we asserted concerning the standing issue on the homeowner's insurer who stepped in, and we would ask that the court reverse this ruling by the trial court, have the judgment set aside as void, and remand it to the trial court for further proceedings, and if I can have my remaining time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Jason Botkins, appearing on behalf of Appalachia Rockingham Mutual Insurance Company. The central issue of this case is whether the trial court properly denied a motion to set aside a judgment that was void, where lapses by the moving party caused the judgment to be void, and the relief was sought under a statute whose language imports permissiveness and discretion. Virginia Code Section 801.428A has been narrowly construed as an exception to the finality of judgments. That narrow construction reflects the fact that the Supreme Court has vigorously enforced Rule 1:1 except where there's a clear statutory exception. Virginia Code Section 801.428A provides that a trial court may set aside a judgment that has one of the defects listed in that subsection, including a judgment that is void.
Counsel, let me interrupt you one second. If what you're saying is correct, if may means may, can you think of a situation where a defendant would not should not receive the benefit of having a judgment declared void? In other words, when would it be appropriate for the judge to exercise his discretion and deny the defendant's motion to set aside?
I think that would be appropriate in circumstances where the defendant or even the moving party has done something, committed lapses, or even engaged in some type of intentional conduct that would disqualify him from relief under this statute.
What kind of intentional conduct could a defendant do that might disqualify him?
An earlier question referred to the subsection or the attribute of fraud on the court. Say if a defendant commits fraud on the court that results in an unfavorable judgment against him or her, then he should not be heard to turn and then try to cite either the fraud on the court that he was facilitating or some other attribute that may qualify him otherwise for relief under the statute.
Counsel, your answer is quite interesting. Based upon that answer, how does your opposing party fit into the dichotomy that you just set up?
Well, I certainly don't believe there is any intentional conduct in this case that would disqualify them from relief under the statute. What I do believe is the trial court rightly found that lapses by the appellant, the party moving for that relief, caused the judgment to become void. Or to be void at its entry.
So you would actually have two reasons why the judge can apply may instead of shall. One would be intentional misconduct. Second would be lapses.
Yes.
What was the lapse on the part of the appellant?
The appellant's counsel in a prior related case personally observed testimony by the defendant in this action that he was not residing at the address that she then used for service process in this case and relied upon then to request the default judgment that she
received.
Is that
part of the record?
It is.
Where is that in the record, please?
That testimony was set forth in the joint appendix beginning page 254.
Okay. Thank you.
The trial court properly applied the plain and ordinary meaning of the word may to conclude that it had discretion to deny the motion set aside brought in this case. And the fact that may and shall are both used in this same statute further supports the trial court's interpretation.
Counsel, how does the Precision Tune case, the 1992 case, factor into your argument, if at all? Charles versus Precision Tune. That ring a bell?
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't have that case synopsis in front of me.
Let me summarize it, and then you can comment on it. It was an independent equity action under subsection D of the same statute, but it was a different court, so it had to be an equity action independently of the motion practice under A. And the court held that, obviously, this is an equitable remedy, and equitable maxims apply, and the defendant was denied a request to enter to vacate a default judgment on the ground that the party seeking equity must be free of fault and neglect, and the party in this particular case was the author of its own misfortune. If that equitable principle were to apply to a defendant, as it did in that case, why wouldn't it also apply to a plaintiff?
I believe it would, Your Honor. I don't see any reason in the reasoning of that case or in the other cases they're brought as that independent equitable action that would rely any moving party to rely upon their own lapses or unclean hands of any sort to qualify for equitable relief from a judgment.
All right, that takes us, at least for me, to the hardest question in the case. how do we define the scope of proper discretion when the allegation is a void ab initio judgment as opposed to avoidable judgment?
Well, I believe if you look to the language of the statute, it governs any motion brought as within the case that the judgment arises from, and it speaks to judgments that are void. I don't know that it's limited to void ab initio.
Right, but assume for the sake of argument that statute does nothing but incorporate equitable principles, and of course discretion is part of equity. How do we define the proper scope of discretion in this kind of case?
I believe the Supreme Court would apply the ordinary standard of review that it applies when reviewing for an abuse of discretion. Did the trial court consider an improper factor? Did the trial court fail to consider an important factor? Or did the trial court consider all appropriate factors to then reach a clear error of judgment? The scope of that discretion would change in a case, for instance, where the defendant brought a motion, was free of any conduct that contributed to the lack of service of process, and is asserting constitutional rights. That's not the case that's before the court today. The case that's before the court today is brought by a moving party who was awarded every last dollar that she sued for at the conclusion of a bench trial on damages.
Counsel, it seems to me that we have two bodies of law that maybe are coming in conflict. One body of law which would say that a void judgment is void for all purposes, and the statute which allows either the plaintiff or the defendant to move to set it aside, and then the body of law which would provide that one may be stopped even if they have a void judgment from asking that that judgment be set aside. The problem that I'm having with my analysis is that the trial court specifically said it was not deciding this case on a estoppel basis. And so help me bridge the gap between void judgments that may always be set aside and a finding that did not reach estoppel.
Well, I believe that a void judgment can be attacked in a variety of different fashions. However, when the chosen manner of attack is brought under this code section, which is a motion brought within the case where the judgment is entered, I think then we have to apply the plain language of the statute. And the plain language of the statute is permissive and imports discretion, and I think at that point the discretion of the trial court allows it to inquire as the facts and circumstances surrounding the motion to set aside. That includes the conduct of the party. That's a similar inquiry that's made in many cases where a party is moving for discretionary relief before the trial court.
But doesn't that very analysis speak of estoppel?
Yes, I would agree with that. And I think there's probably an element of the estoppel that may be subsumed by the trial court's analysis in determining whether or not an exercise of discretion was proper in this case. If you look at the trial court's letter opinion, you'll see that one of the bases of the denying the motion was that appellant twice asserted proper service of process in her motion for default judgment, and then the court acted on those requests and awarded her the judgment that she sought.
Could right result, wrong reason apply?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that it could. Judicial estoppel would constitute, I believe, a separate basis for affirming the trial court's ruling. Certainly, there was representations that were inconsistent that were made within this case, the first being proper service of process based on the fact that appellant asserted that the address she used was appropriate or was proper, and then later, after receiving the default judgment, then asserting that service of process was incorrect and that the defendant indeed lived at a different address. The address the defendant resided at and was used for process would be an assertion of fact rather than a conclusion of law. Finally, the trial court certainly relied upon those assertions, or it would not have awarded the default judgment that was sought.
Now, are you in that argument, are you assuming that judicial estoppel is the whole of equity law? Isn't it just one tiny subset of a library of equitable principles that filter cases?
Yes, I agree with that.
So if judicial estoppel is on the table or off the table, is that the only equitable ground that the trial court could have relied upon to exercise discretion?
I think an exercise of discretion in itself has equitable principles that are inherent, and when it reviews the record or reviews the facts and circumstances surrounding that motion for discretionary relief and determines whether or not to grant it.
So what's the end game? Suppose hypothetically the court were to affirm. Where does this case go from here, and what happens to the deck action?
I believe that the deck action then is mooted, because at the point that the judgment or a finding that the judgment is void is affirmed and becomes final, then as a matter of law in the deck action, UM provider can't be responsible for paying a judgment that is void as a matter of law. So I think the deck action goes away with the ruling from this court.
If the judgment is not set aside, isn't the judgment going to be enforceable against Mr. Ferguson?
I think that's a question that arises once some type of enforcement is attempted against him. I think then he has an opportunity to be heard and present whatever relief he believes is necessary. But again, if you've got to avoid judgment, I don't know that the appellant can enforce that judgment against
Why couldn't he? If the court says it's not setting a judgment aside. It's a judgment is a judgment, right?
I don't believe so. I believe a judgment is a judgment only if it's not void. If you have a finding by this court or by a trial court that the judgment is void, then the appellant should be stopped from enforcing that judgment against
the defendant. At that point in time, can't the appellant sue the defendant again?
I believe they're bound by judicial estoppel. There is a court order that has adjudicated plaintiff's cause against the defendant that remains in place.
I don't understand.
I thought the whole point was Ferguson can raise the void ab initio in defense of a 5A writ or some enforcement action, but that the architect of the void judgment, the plaintiffs, can't. I thought that was the point of this case.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
Why can't, if the trial judge were affirmed in this case and the exercise of discretion upheld under whatever the proper scope is, why couldn't Sauter then sue Ferguson or bring an enforcement action on an existing judgment and Ferguson reply by saying, well, this is void ab initio, and win it? That would be the result, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so the end game is the plaintiffs, the only recovery Ms. Sauter has is against the E&O policy somewhere, but not against Ferguson.
Yes, that's correct.
Why wouldn't Ferguson be collaterally stopped from doing that? He's a party to this proceeding right here, and it's being decided by the court. This judgment cannot be set aside because it's void. So why isn't he bound by that?
I think he would be entitled to rely upon a finding that the judgment is void in any enforcement action, regardless as to whether or not he's participated in the case today.
Well, was he served in this case properly?
He was not.
So he's not a party to the court.
But he's a party to the motion that has been filed.
I don't believe that. I'm sorry?
He's a party to the motion to set aside, is he not?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. He was subpoenaed and gave testimony as a witness as to whether or not he'd received process, but he has never approved of or joined in the motion to set aside the judgment at any time. In fact, during the hearing on the motion to set aside, he gave testimony as a witness and then left the proceeding immediately afterward.
So did Ferguson ever make a general appearance?
That's correct.
Did Ferguson ever make a general appearance?
He did not, Your Honor, as far as I can tell.
And did he ever waive service of process?
He did not.
Okay, so he'll be able to defend any enforcement action later.
Yes, that would be my understanding, Your Honor. Rockingham Mutual would respectfully ask
one more
that.
Other question, sir. Absolutely. Earlier, I asked you a question with regard to when a trial judge could treat the may in the statute as may rather than shall. You originally answered that when there was fraud on the court, and then in response to the question, you also indicated that when you have, and I don't remember your exact words, but essentially when you have actual knowledge in this instance of where he was living, and yet you tried to serve him somewhere else. You recall that colloquy?
Yes, Your Honor.
At the time, you pointed me to page 250 of the 250-251 of the joint appendix. Would you turn there?
Yes, Your Honor.
Help me understand what it is that I'm seeing. It appears that I'm seeing a deposition of Mr. Ferguson in a different action than what we are litigating today. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But arising out of the same transaction, the same collision?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And at that time, the plaintiff was Progressive Insurance Company, and there were four defendants, one of whom is Ms. Souter, the plaintiff or the appellant in the action that we're litigating today.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. Okay.
Your law firm was present. In fact, the deposition occurred at your law firm. But at the time, Ms. Souter was not being represented by the attorney who was representing her in this action, and in fact, the attorney representing her in this action was not present at that deposition. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So your response is that because she was represented by counsel, and I don't believe she was actually present, because she was represented by counsel in a distinct action where Mr. Ferguson, in response to one of many questions, indicated where he was living at the time of the collision, that knowledge of her attorney at that time is imputed to her attorney in this action, and that if he instead relies upon the traffic report, the collision report, and what's on Mr. Ferguson's driver's license, he is he's prejudiced thereby. Is there anything in the record indicating that the information that came out at that deposition was actually received by her counsel in this action?
There's nothing in the record to reflect that.
I don't want to hear anything that's outside of the record.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I would suggest, though, that the analysis should be not what one attorney representing the appellant in one case knew versus what her other attorney in the second case knew. I believe that her attorney's knowledge is imputed to her. It's what did the appellant know or should have known with respect to this information.
Okay. And that was an insurance defense attorney representing her in that action. She was some sort of a secondary or tertiary defendant in a coverage case, is that right?
My understanding was that was her primary counsel that was not retained by any insurance company.
Okay. Where is do you have any law that would you could point me to that the knowledge of one attorney in one action is imputed to another attorney in another action?
I can. Can I?
So. By all means, please do so.
The case is cited in Appellee's brief. It's Blinder & Company versus State Corporation Commission. The parenthetical citation to that case, this is on page 22.
No, I can find it now. Great. Okay, thank you.
Sure. Your time has expired.
All right, thank you.
Rebuttal.
Just responding briefly, Your Honors, to a couple of things I heard in the argument there. If, in fact, the statute in this case, 428A, does not allow a plaintiff who has obtained, by mistake, a void judgment, to move to set aside that judgment and to have the court set it aside if, in fact, the facts establish that it's void for lack of jurisdiction. I'm at a loss as to why the statute
Let me interrupt a little bit, counsel. Certainly, I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. A plaintiff who's trying to do the right thing, made a mistake, got a void judgment, wants to set aside. That's not this case, though. This case is because you got a judgment that you can't enforce. So you're not doing this to benefit the defendant. You're doing it to benefit your client. Does that make a difference?
I'm not exactly sure that it makes a difference why the judgment is void. It's void from the outset, regardless of how it got that way. Truth is, we are trying to do the right thing, but also we would like to try to salvage the plaintiff's claim for her. And so that puts us in a unique position, I believe.
You may end up with a larger judgment against the defendant than you have now, right?
Or we could get zero.
Sure.
All we want is our day in court, which is so far not what we've had.
Okay.
And so that's the reason for moving the judgment.
Actually, you had your day in court. You got a $300,000 judgment, but you just can't enforce it.
Well, but we would like a trier of fact to be able to make those determinations as opposed to a procedural snag. And so that's the purpose of us doing this, and one of the purposes, but also the statute allows it. I mean, there are no restrictions in the statute as to whether it was obtained by some lapses on the part of the plaintiff. Frequently, plaintiffs do have some lapses in trying to get personal jurisdiction in cases, and that brings us to this kind of a case. It's not very often, however, that the plaintiff who happens to obtain that judgment is also in the position of saying, wait a minute, let's back up and start this over again because this isn't right. Not only did we not have a viable judgment against Denny Ferguson, but, you know, I think there's plenty of fault to be spread around in this case in terms of why service process was not obtained and notice was given as to the appropriate procedural posture of the case before the judgment was entered and let the 21 days run.
All right, your time has expired as well. We have your arguments, and I think everybody understands it. Call the next case.